What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Wait, don't go. I've got some questions.
Shouldn't I stop making movies and do something that counts, like helping blind people or becoming a missionary or something?
Let me tell you, you're not the missionary type. You'd never last. And incidentally, you're also not Superman. You're a comedian. You want to do mankind a real service? Tell funnier jokes.
See if you can follow me here, Adam. That's Woody Allen directing himself, playing a director, very much like himself, in his 1980 film Stardust Memories.
I got it.
This week on the show, inspired by Ben Affleck's Argo, we'll count down our top five favorite movies directed by their stars.
It's okay that my entire top five is made up of Woody Allen films, right?
I sort of expected it.
We'll also review Argo and answer the age-old question, who's the private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right, our Blaxploitation marathon begins with Shaft.
All that and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it?
Film Spotting is presented by the new Squarespace, the easiest way to create an exceptional website. There's no credit card required to try it out. Simply go to squarespace.com/film and start your trial. Make sure to use the offer code FILM10 when you purchase for a 10% discount.
And by FreshBooks, the cloud accounting service for small businesses. A service, Josh, I have to confess, I wish I had known about last week, as I was in a position where I had to send an invoice to a sponsor. It's not something I have to do very often, and so I didn't have any kind of template prepared. I had to create one from scratch. I didn't really know what an invoice should look like. And now here we are being sponsored by FreshBooks, and I can't wait to try out their service. So when this happens again, I'll know exactly what to do, because if you're in business for yourself, you know that it takes a lot of time to create invoices and deal with all that business paperwork. FreshBooks has been around since 2004. It's a cloud accounting service that will save you time and get you paid faster. They even have an iPhone app that allows you to track expenses and create invoices on the go.
With FreshBooks, you can create invoices easily and email them to your clients. Your clients can view the invoices online and pay you right on the spot with a credit card. You can also turn timesheets instantly into invoices and run all kinds of great reports to monitor your small business. Of course, since you're so organized with all this, your accountant is going to love you at tax time.
They also offer automated late payment reminders to follow up with clients, and you can call or email FreshBooks customer support and get a live person to reply. That's always key. FreshBooks lets you try their service for free right now. You can sign up, get 30 days of unlimited use, all the features, clients, staff, everything with no limits, just by signing up at FreshBooks.com. When you do, be sure to tell them that you heard about it from Film Spotting when you're asked during sign-up, because there is no other code or URL to use. You got to tell them you came from Film Spotting, and if you sign up right now, again, you get 30 days of unlimited use. So why not join the 5 million FreshBook users that have been sending and paying invoices at FreshBooks.com? We thank FreshBooks for their support. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. We have another terribly accented edition of Massacre Theater and our top five movies directed by their stars coming up later in the show.
But first, we find out how well Ben Affleck directs Ben Affleck in Argo.
Actions of Iran have shocked the civilized world.
Go, go, go! Everything.
Our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
If we're going to go, then we need to go now.
What happened?
Six of the hostages went out a back exit.
Where are they? The Canadian ambassador's house.
You got Revolutionary Guards going door to door.
These people die. They die badly.
White House?
Who wants the six of them out?
What we like for this are bicycles.
Deliver the six bikes, provide them with maps.
Or you could just send in training wheels and meet them at the border with Gatorade.
It's gonna take a miracle to get them out.
There's an obvious Argo setup question I could go with here that ties into our poll question last week on the show. Looking forward to our discussion of Ben Affleck's third film behind the camera, we asked which of these three actors turned directors is off to the best start: Affleck, George Clooney, or Jon Favreau. Spoiler alert, Favreau bombed in this poll as badly as Cowboys and Aliens did at the box office, but at least one listener almost voted for him. Dion Anderson writes, "Before this morning, I was ready to vote for Jon Favreau as I've loved his work as both a director and an actor. However, having just got back from seeing Argo, my vote has to go to Ben Affleck. First of all, I thought it was a great movie, albeit somewhat manipulative, as anyone who has seen it must agree. For pure enjoyment and edge-of-the-seat suspense, I can't remember the last time I liked a movie so much. I am putting Affleck on my list of directors whose films I will go to simply because he is directing. Josh, you went with Clooney in the poll, so I'm tempted to ask if Argo, which Clooney actually co-produced, gave you any pause before casting your vote, and whether Affleck is a director whose attachment to a project now holds the same kind of cachet for you as it does for Dion. But instead, I'm going to ask you about Argo's harrowing recent real-life parallels that Affleck and screenwriter Chris Terrio couldn't really have conceived of. The movie is based on the true story of the CIA's literally made-for-Hollywood rescue of six U.S. Foreign Service workers from Tehran during the 1979 Iran hostage crisis. The six managed to escape the American embassy during an attack by a mob of Islamic militants responding to the U.S.'s support of the Shah, who fled during the Iranian Revolution. Watching the embassy ordeal, which Affleck vividly recreates, I couldn't help but think about the eruption of violence that occurred 6 weeks ago in Benghazi, Libya. The terrorist attack left U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans dead. So as much as Argo may be a Hollywood thriller about the making of a fake Hollywood action movie, the subject matter isn't just the stuff of fantasy or of history. Does Affleck display the sophistication and sensitivity to handle it?
I think this is the question more people should be asking of Argo, and I'm kind of surprised that it's not being asked. Those are the two key words, sophistication and sensitivity. I think those are the things that are lacking in Argo, and that's what bothered me the most about it. But I want to start by setting aside any real-life parallels. I think they're important, and I think they count. But even without those, I think that Argo is a troubling film in the sense of the assumptions it's working with and the attitude it has towards a foreign setting and a story that is an American story, but really does involve itself with another country, with the people of another country, and does so in a way that's distinctly myopic that American films can often have, specifically Hollywood films. This is a really slippery movie because it is suspenseful, as you mentioned, and it works on a lot of levels. But what troubled me about it is how it gets to that suspense. I agree it's suspenseful, but it relies on a troubling sort of fear that borders on a xenophobia that Hollywood films have, where it's all built around fear of the other and demonizing another. And in this case, it happens to be the Iranians. Now, I want to set aside, I'm not saying that the Iranians in the real historical account who did go after the hostages were good people and they're being portrayed as bad here. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that the movie relies on things such as only focusing on men with dark beards and dark eyes glowering at the camera, people shouting things in another language with rifles and weapons, busy crowds in unfamiliar streets, dark alleys. The entire attitude of the movie is to put us in a place that's being demonized because of its foreignness, if that makes sense. And I just found that troubling as I was watching it. It was sort of in the back of my head. And then I noticed that it was a recurring motif that was being used throughout the film to kind of drive our fear that way. And when I put all those pieces together, I honestly came out of it feeling quite uncomfortable. Now you layer on top of that the topical aspect you're discussing, and not only something like the attacks on Benghazi, but also the fact that in political circles, there's talk of war with Iran, going to war with Iran. And I think we have to take that into consideration, that a movie which portrays a country in this way, how that might affect people's perception of that country in the current time.
Well, I'm glad I asked the right question. I have to say, though, that my answer to the question is completely the opposite of yours. I couldn't disagree more. And based on what you've said, and knowing that you did give this film a very low star rating in your written review on your website, I have to admit to you that my instinct is to come out guns blazing, full on Delta Force mode. I'm going to try, though, to go with the Jimmy Carter diplomacy approach, even though we see how well that works out for Jimmy Carter in the movie Argo. I'm with Dion, though. Argo was, for me, among my favorite movie-going experiences of the year. It's not without its heavy-handedness, some of the same heavy-handedness that kept me from fully embracing Affleck's previous films, Gone Baby Gone and The Town. We'll get to some of that. But look, this isn't Syriana, nor is it trying to be. This is an action movie. It's a rescue thriller, and Affleck does always lean that way. But maybe the biggest reason why this movie works so well for me, the reason it's so suspenseful, Josh, is precisely because Affleck is a sophisticated enough storyteller to understand that the way you generate a pressure cooker situation, with all the tension this movie has is by making the stakes for both sides explicitly clear. We certainly know the U.S. isn't going to cave, and we're rooting for the six people to get out. But we also know that the Iranians aren't going to cave either, because what they're fighting for is just, they seem, understandably, to be the aggrieved party watching this film. And I do think Affleck makes that clear. If at any point the viewer starts to think, oh, they're just angry, freedom-hating, violent people, eventually they're going to get tired of this, this is just a political charade of some kind that they'll get over, the whole movie is sunk. Affleck gets that we have to recognize why the Iranians are waging this battle and that they're in it for the long haul. Maybe you're forgetting all the times the film cuts to an Iranian woman on TV or in person reading, in English as I recall, the Iranian message to the world, outlining all of their grievances and their demands for justice. Maybe you're not giving enough credit to the opening storyboard sequences where we get a history lesson on how the Shah came to power, how the Americans and British installed this despot that wrought all this havoc on the Iranian people, on his own country. So we know how justified the Iranian people are for wanting some form of retribution. And I was constantly aware of that while watching the film, that not only did I understand the reasons for their anger, but I sympathized with them. It certainly struck me as I was watching the movie that maybe they should even win this dispute, Josh, even though politically, as the movie explains, the U.S. could never allow that. I felt like justice was largely on their side in at least their aggravation with the American government. And I give Affleck a lot of credit for allowing those shades of gray to come through.
Let's start with that storyboard sequence at the opening, which is really almost a comic book sequence. That's the style it's kind of using.
Yeah,
that's how
but I think
took
it's
it.
Meant to be storyboards thought, like the film Argo.
Yeah, we see storyboards from Argo later in the film, so it is a recurring motif. And I thought it was a little bit odd, to be honest with you, at the beginning that we were seeing recent Iranian history in that way. But yeah, it's a Hollywood film. I know it's about movies. Okay. But to me, it's symbolic of the approach that this entire film takes, which is one of cultural imperialism imposing a U.S. point of view, a very myopic point of view, which only concerns itself with the heroes making it out and using fear of the other to generate
that
suspense.
But imagine if we didn't get that opening sequence. Imagine if the movie just launched us into the embassy under attack. He could have done that. Instead,
yeah,
Affleck clearly chose not to.
I'm not imagining another movie. I'm responding to the one I saw. And the
right.
one I saw, that comic book opening, struck me as an odd way to introduce
I don't
us to another culture's
book.
History.
I think we have to disagree
storyboard.
On that.
The storyboard opening, I found it to be an odd way. You also mentioned language with the Iranian commentator in English making their case.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's there. Far more forceful as a film technique are the frequent instances of Iranian characters screaming at the U.S. characters, or just screaming in general, and we don't get any subtitles there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a conscious decision to create these people as angry Iranians. The others were fearful of them. We don't understand what they're saying. They're unintelligible. It's a way of making a character unintelligible is to make their language something that's loud and we can't perceive. I mean, the very way we come to learn another culture is watching foreign films that are subtitled for us.
Mm-hmm.
This is a shutting off of that sort of connection and communication. And it's used throughout the film. It's a tactic that troubled me.
Okay. You got six people hiding out in the town of what? 4 million people, all of whom chant death to America all the livelong day. You want to set up a movie in a week. You want to lie to Hollywood, a town where everybody lies for a living. Then you're going to sneak 007 over here into a country that wants CIA blood on their breakfast cereal. And you're going to walk the Brady Bunch out of the most watched city in the world.
Asked about 100 militia at the airport. That's right.
Right. Look, I got to tell you, we did suicide missions in the Army that had better odds than this.
You're listening to Film Spotting. The movie we're arguing about is the new film from director and star of this movie, Ben Affleck. I understand what you're saying about the times in the film where we don't see subtitles and when we're not sure what the angry Iranian people are saying. But the fact is, I think if we went back and really dissected those scenes, there's a ton of people yelling and shouting, and it would be almost unintelligible to even subtitle those moments. Plus, the fact is, if you've ever had anyone yelling at you passionately, the fact is a good majority of what people are often yelling can be overlooked because they're just spewing bile. That certainly comes through here in some of these scenes. But I think more importantly, Josh, I disagree with you. In every instance that someone who isn't subtitled is yelling at one of our American heroes, we know in every case what they're yelling about. And the fact is, I think it's a great storytelling technique that Affleck imposes here, which is pretty obviously intended to put us, the audience, in the same position as the hostages. There's a key scene in the market, for example. This is the first time they get to go out after they've been hiding out in the Canadian ambassador's home for, I think, something like 45 days or maybe a little bit more than that. Only one of the six people in their group speaks Farsi, and of course, he can't really use it because it would blow his cover. So you've got a group of people completely overwhelmed, Josh, by the sights, the sounds, the furor, and the frustration of the people they're surrounded by. And we, because of how Affleck shoots it, end up being just as lost and scared as they are. It's a very effective technique. It's their first venture out, as I said. It's kind of a test run for the climax of the film. The whole point is to emphasize how badly things could go for them, to amp up the drama for the climax. And I hear what you're saying about the quote-unquote fear of the other, but when you have a movie where that fear is very justified simply because they're in such a situation where if they step outside, they could get shot on the spot, I think that's justified.
I understand that the fear is going to be a part of the story. I'm not asking for a film about this story that doesn't rely on fear, but it's the underlying assumptions under that fear that is what bothers me. And I'll take that marketplace scene as an example of what I'm talking about. You had said this is a lot of shouting and we wouldn't be able to understand
it
anyway.
It's like 10, 12
voices
at least.
There is one direct encounter with an older man that sets it off, a shopkeeper, where he comes up to one of the Americans and accuses her of something.
And we know what he
accuses
her of.
That is a conversation.
There's a line of dialogue.
It's not a matter of information. It doesn't mean that if we could...
I don't need to know more reasons why he's upset.
I'm not saying if we knew what he was talking about, that it would make me feel better. I don't need the information. It's the tone. It's that here is another Iranian who looks scary and is yelling, and we're not giving what they're talking about. Where he's not seen as a person. And this film progressively sets up by relying on this technique, not just in one or two instances, but relying on it throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
And from the very opening in the beginning, where Iranian history is ours too, because we're seeing it in storyboard form, what it sets up and eventually ends with is very much an us versus them dichotomy. That's how the film runs on. And sorry, but I find that troublesome in films when, especially Hollywood films, approach another culture that way. And I think it needs to be called out because I think it's something that can just sail by and we take it for granted and we don't realize how it can form our own worldviews and our own perceptions of other cultures.
Well, obviously, I disagree. I think that market sequence is very good. And I think precisely because, as I said, it puts us in the same situation as the people we're rooting for. And I know why that guy's upset. And I don't blame him for being upset. We get the line of dialogue that explains. I don't need to hear every word he's saying to understand more about his worldview.
No, but it makes him more human.
It comes through very clear.
It makes him more human.
I thought he was human watching
words.
It, Josh. I thought
no
he was
way.
Human the moment I was watching it. I think
they're
they
almost
all
like
are.
Zombies in
no,
that scene.
I
they're coming
completely.
Out of the dark alleys, and it's such a scary place. And I understand, again, that fear.
Of course it's
yes,
going to be.
Fear needs to be a part of it.
They could be killed just for being American in that moment, Josh. Of course that's going to come through.
I understand that. But again, by projecting them as these zombie-like creatures that can barely even talk.
I think maybe that says more about your perception watching them than the perception of the film, because I never felt that watching it. And in fact, I go back to, as I said, all the moments where we go back to that woman explaining what their problem is with the American government, making that explicitly clear, going back to the great history lesson we get at the beginning of the movie. Affleck did that for a reason, precisely because I think he wanted to not only make the storytelling stakes abundantly clear, but because he probably wanted to avoid exactly these kind of charges. And I think he successfully did it.
A woman talking to a camera and giving us the history or the political point of view is not as powerful as the emotional, cathartic use of cinema that's being used in the fear scenes.
Hmm.
Those are much more powerful. That is what an audience is going to be left with.
Well, let's talk about some things that, for me, didn't work with the film, because certainly there are some of those elements. I'll say that Affleck, in the lead role, and we haven't really talked about the plot at all, which, frankly, I don't feel that bad about. If you haven't seen the movie and you want to know more about the plot, you can find plenty of clips or synopses online. But Affleck plays Tony Mendez, who is the CIA exfiltrator. He's the guy whose job it is to set up this scheme of making a Hollywood film, shooting it in Iran, and they're all location scouts. They're just trying to make a movie, and he's going to get them out. I think Affleck, as our lead here, is very bland. It's almost as
bland.
If Affleck's approach to the character was deliberately to try to make him as boring as possible, to strip away everything and make him almost a ghost walking around, a CIA spook.
Where is your passport issued?
Vancouver.
Where were you born?
Toronto.
Toronto. Canadians don't pronounce the T.
Some Comité guard is actually going to know that.
If you're detained for questioning, they will bring in someone who knows that. Yes. Mary, who were the last three prime ministers of Canada?
Trudeau, Pearson, and Diefenbaker.
What's your father's name?
Howard.
What's his occupation?
Fisherman.
Where were you born?
Halifax, Nova Scotia.
What's your date of birth?
February 21st, 1952.
Good. What's your job on the movie?
Producer.
Associate producer. What was the last movie you produced?
High and Dry.
Who paid for that?
CFDC.
What's your middle name? What's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Leon?
Shoot him. He's an American spy.
Maybe he was trying to make him unmemorable in every way, and he's just someone who's there to do his job, get in, get out before you notice anything's missing. It doesn't derail the film by any stretch for me because this isn't a character study, as we've said. The star here is the plan and the action. That's what the film's about. Nevertheless, I do think he's a bland hero.
I think that is a fault, though, because there's a sequence where he has to make a decision that's a crucial decision, a little bit possibly out of character, mm-hmm. if we had any sense of what his character
was. It does seem weightless.
It's weightless. Yeah. That's a good word for it, because that's supposed to be a big moment. It doesn't register as that because the performance has been so dull.
I think as well, Affleck can't help himself here and tries to infuse too much sentimentality, too much of a character arc, despite the fact that, as we've noted, it's not really a character study, to try to up the emotional ante. He's estranged from his wife and his young son. We also meet Alan Arkin's character, who's this composite of various Hollywood figures who helped out with the escape. And he's also divorced, and they have a conversation about how he's a bad father. And initially, I really liked all these elements, Josh, because I thought Affleck was doing it in a subtle way. He was using that angle to add some poignancy, but in a subtle way, because there is an obvious parallel to a father essentially abandoning his son and a country potentially abandoning its people. There's a parallel as well to a father absolving himself of responsibility and a country doing the same. So I recognize that element. The question was whether Affleck could just leave it at that, or would he go for it and draw it out and try to get that big emotional payoff? And of course, this being a Hollywood film, that's exactly what he does.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work either. And I have to say, you mentioned that I gave an exceptionally low rating. It wasn't because of this main aspect I'm talking about alone. I found a couple of other faults, including Affleck's performance and the performances. Maybe it's not so much the performances. The supporting characters, the American hostages, mm-hmm. never really came to life to me, despite the fact that there are a significant number of scenes with them. We clearly get the married couple. We see that. That's all that defines them, that we know that they're married. We get the guy who's the de facto leader, so we get a little taste of his character. But beyond that, they're largely ciphers. And I think that's another way you could have heightened the tension rather than playing up the fear thing I'm talking about. You could have heightened the tension by making these really living, breathing, mm-hmm. full characters you come to care about so much that the slightest ounce of fear involving them would have registered more. But instead, I never get a sense for who they were, what they were invested in, why they were there. We learn some of this information, but it never comes to life in a way that you're fully invested in what happens to them.
That's a valid criticism, though. I didn't really feel it. I think in fairness to Affleck, we do have to recognize the canvas he's painting with here and all of the elements and all the people that are part of this film. And maybe it's just not realistic to expect that all six of those people are going to be fully fleshed out characters. I do think that a couple of them stand out, including one of the married couples, Scoot McNairy and Carrie Bechet. They have a little bit more of a prominent role, especially McNairy. So I think they work. And I also really do like the scenes with Alan Arkin and John Goodman, who play the Hollywood team back in L.A. that are making this ruse seem legitimate. They provide some comic relief. And of course, they're two fantastic actors, so they do it well.
Yeah, their scenes work well. And I also think one of the sequences that does work really well involves them, where they set up a script reading for Argo.
Fantastic.
And they bring in actors in costume to read this. And Affleck intercuts it with scenes of the hostages in Iran back
right.
and forth and parallel that. I thought that was a really strong instance of parallel filmmaking, showed maybe the best example of his talent as a director.
You know why those parallels work so well? It's because of this element that runs throughout the film, even with Tony Mendez and Affleck's bland portrayal, in this notion of sacrifice. This idea that CIA agents like himself, like these foreign service workers who go over and sacrifice so much to help the cause in dangerous places like Iran, they do it without getting any glory or any fame whatsoever. And then you juxtapose that with these people who are willing to dress up in these ridiculous costumes and essentially make fools out of themselves, all because they're pursuing some little piece of that glory. They just want their name on a billboard, their name in lights, whatever it takes, they're willing to do it. So I agree that that's a really effective sequence. But since you said something positive finally, I'm going to say something else negative about the film.
You owe me a negative, yeah.
Exactly, which is that Affleck not only can't help himself but upping the emotional ante, he also can't resist pulling out every suspenseful stop. I'm actually surprised that in the last 20 or 30 minutes, we all know it's going to the climactic sequence where they're going to try to get to the airport and get out of the country. I'm surprised the van they were driving in didn't actually get a flat tire on the way and they almost missed their flight, because he goes so far with it. There's tension, and then there's tension where you are very aware that a director is manipulating you. And I think he cranks the dial a little bit too far. I'll admit that in the moment, I fell for it hook, line, and sinker.
Sure,
I was on the edge of my seat. But I wonder if it wouldn't be a richer film if he had taken his foot off the gas pedal just a little bit. I'd rather leave the movie asking myself, wow, could it have really happened like that? Rather than knowing as it's happening, there's no way it possibly happened like that. And so even as I was finally breathing a sigh of relief at the end of the film and felt like I'd been through something profound, I did feel that manipulation and wish that he'd backed off a little bit. And I actually think as well that when you consider the elements that are true or not true, that doesn't really matter to me in the grand scheme of things. But where I do think it becomes problematic is when you watch that end sequence and you are so aware that there's no way it went down like this. You're aware that it has to be a Hollywood construction. And then you see at the end of the film, Affleck decides over the credits to show you side-by-side pictures of the shots from the movie and the shots from real life that clearly were the inspiration or that reflect these moments actually happening back in 1979. And I thought that that was an uneasy type of verisimilitude to suggest. I wish that after seeing that big Hollywood fantasy on screen, he had left it alone rather than trying to show us, oh, but look at how real it is. Look
yeah,
at how
close
it seems
close like he's trying to justify that Hollywood ending he had. Yeah, I can see that. That Hollywood ending is quite amped up. They tighten the screws way more than necessary.
Argo is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with us, I look forward to the emails on this. You can send us a comment to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Well, since the FCC has banned us from singing after last week's show, we'll simply read our lines next for Massacre Theater. Then it's time for turtleneck sweaters and leather jackets as our Blaxploitation Marathon kicks off with Shaft. Stay with us.
All it'll take is just one moment and you can say goodbye to how we had it planned. Fear like a habit, run like a rabbit out and away. The screen door to the unknown. And I wanna love you and more. I wanna find you and more. Where do you reside when you hide? How can I find you? 'Cause I wanna send you and more.
Very excited to have a new sponsor this week, FreshBooks, the cloud accounting service for small businesses that saves time and gets you paid faster. They have over 5 million FreshBooks users, and you can try the service for free for 30 days. You'll get unlimited use at FreshBooks.com. Be sure to let them know you heard about it on Film Spotting.
We're also very pleased to be brought to you once again by Squarespace.com. We have another website from a listener to recommend, Josh, if you want to see what Squarespace looks like in action. This is a longtime listener, Ben Alsip, in Uptown here in Chicago. Admittedly, I was hesitant to recommend Squarespace to my girlfriend, brother, and his wife, who've started up Lighthouse Yoga and Acupuncture nearby in Evanston, Illinois. As a graphic designer who knows little about web programming, I was accustomed to handing over my web designs to a coder, but Squarespace saved them a boatload of money and all of us a good deal of time as we rushed to get the site up in time for the first day of classes. Check them out at lighthouseyoga.com. Thanks for the recommendation, discount, and years of cinematic provocation. It is always fun to hear from Film Spotting listeners who use Squarespace's service. The site really does work well for all of our creative type listeners. We have a lot of graphic designers out there and artists and aspiring filmmakers, and they have templates to showcase your films, videos, and reviews in a gallery, collage, or slideshow. It's very easy to use. It's all drag and drop. Everything's integrated: design, domains, hosting, and support, which is 24/7 customer support that responds in minutes.
Go to squarespace.com/film. Squarespace is $10 a month for the standard plan and $20 a month for the unlimited plan. If you sign up for a year, you automatically get 20% off. And if you sign up for 2 years, you get 25% off. Don't forget to use the offer code FILM10 to get an additional 10% off during checkout.
Live like a pharaoh, sing like a sparrow.
You all done? You know, just because people are going to ask, was that thing even loaded?
It's okay. This is all going to be okay.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. And that very memorable, very creepy scene from David Fincher's great film Zodiac gives us a chance to tease next week's top five, Josh. In honor of Halloween, we are going to share our top five terrifying characters. I think the Zodiac killer from the film Zodiac probably qualifies.
He probably would qualify, but he's off screen so
exactly.
much. I don't know if that
but
counts.
But that's kind of also what makes him so scary, is that we see so little of him and hear so little of him. So that unknown factor plays a major role, I think, in how much we fear him. But it also gives us a chance to talk about the passing, the unfortunate passing of cinematographer Haris Savides, probably best known for working with Fincher on Zodiac, on The Game, and also with Gus Van Sant. They made the Death Trilogy together, Last Days, Elephant. He also shot Milk, which is a film I really love the cinematography on. I love actually the way Savides shoots San Francisco, which we see in both Milk and Zodiac. Of course, he also shot Margot at the Wedding, American Gangster, and other films, and passed away last week, I believe October 10th. That was really unfortunate, age 55.
Last Days is the one that sticks out to me, just the ghostly imagery that came as a surprise in that film and works so beautifully.
Well, we move from that sad news, hopefully, on to a little bit of fun. It is time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a beloved screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, boy, did we ever massacre this scene.
We had
radio interviews.
Radio interviews.
Yeah.
Three radio interviews. And, you know, at some point, a good friend of ours said, "You know, you've got all these great songs that you do about your terriers, and you're do something with them, because you're celebrities now." And
we
and
never thought of it. We were just doing it for fun, just for the love of terriers. But thinking, why not?
There's something to be said for that.
Backyard, front yard, or the barn, play with it.
That's Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara as Jerry and Cookie Fleck from the 2000 film Best in Show, directed by Christopher Guest, screenplay by Guest and Levy. And there's a nice tie-in, actually, to this week's show, as Guest is always one of the ensemble members in his films, but that's not where we were going with it.
No, Alyssa Woodall in Austin, Texas, figured out what we meant. She wrote, "This week's Massacre Theater is, of course, Best in Show, tying in with your top five movie pets list. I was listening to the show while at work, and once you started what can only be called shrieking, I started to cringe and wince as my eardrums got a savage beating. During that time, my boss noticed my face and thought I had contracted a stomach bug that had been going around the office. She politely said that if I was sick, then I should go home. Since I had to leave early anyway, I took the offer and left. So thank you guys for singing so poorly that you got me out of work. Also, I have to give props to Josh for his interesting Eugene Levy impression, sounding like a mix between Ethel Merman and Joe Pesci."
I was trying to put my finger on it. Alyssa nailed it.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Huh? "Keep up the great work, guys. And don't ever do that to me again.
Well, all I can say, Alyssa, is I really hope your boss doesn't listen to Film Spotting.
No,
because
kidding.
You might get written up. Rob McKinnon, formerly of Toronto, newly of Little Britain, Ontario, wrote in with this note. He said, I loved Best in Show the first time I saw it, but since then, my wife and I have started showing our German short-haired pointers in both Canada and the U.S. We now have a new appreciation for the movie and can attest to the fact that it's funny because it's true. We have seen real-life versions of every character in that film, and they're often even more ridiculous than portrayed in the movie. Although I have yet to meet anyone who literally has two left feet, I won't be surprised when I do. If you want to hear our horrible singing or Josh's Ethel Merman / Joe Pesci impression, or maybe our top five movie pets list, you can hear that at filmspotting.net or get it via iTunes. Also on last week's show was my interview with Martin McDonagh, who wrote and directed the new film Seven Psychopaths.
No singing there, right?
No singing that I can remember in that conversation, but there is a Shih Tzu named Bonnie that plays a major role in that film. So that's where we were going with our pets and best in show, and we did get a lot of entries, Josh. So reach into the brimming Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Winner is Ryan Jacobs from Nashville, Tennessee.
Congratulations, Ryan. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
Well, the hits just keep on coming. We go from singing to another accented edition of Massacre Theater presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
So the only hint you're getting here, even though we should probably give them more, because I don't think we're going to get a lot of entries. I think
this will be
probably
tougher.
This is a movie that's a little bit underseen, and there's nothing really in the scene that ties in directly to our top five list, but it is inspired by our top five movies this week, directed by their stars. One of the stars and the director of the film appears in this scene. So we'll tell you that. Josh, you start the scene off. I can't wait. Are you ready?
Yeah, I've done this accent before, so I've got it
down.
You
have. You've had some practice. I don't know if it's going to make perfect or not. And action.
I want this to be when I am a more set.
Set?
Yes.
Oh, so it's about finances.
Well,
it's about money.
No, it's not about money, okay? And don't make it sound like that. Don't make it like, okay, it's not like, okay. Because I'm working here trying to do something that is very hard. And then, you know, my brother's driving me crazy, okay? I'm just saying that it's about money. Yes, it's about money. Okay, if you want me to say yes, it's money. I'm sorry, if you don't understand money, okay? You don't understand.
I understand
it's
money.
Difficult.
I work in a bank.
What did you say?
I understand money.
And scene.
Scene. The film is not Super Mario Brothers, the movie. I regret
to
inform
you. Why'd you give it away?
You. If you know what movie we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, October 23rd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
We're going to need a diplomat to dig you out of this hole.
To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You had a twin sister stillborn, strangled by your umbilical cord. Your first hit. Your mother always wanted a daughter. She blamed you for your sister's death, so until your sister Phoebe was born, she raised you as a girl. What else? Your father, the dentist. Not really your father.
Well, speaking of movies directed by their stars, there's George Clooney in that scene with Sam Rockwell as Chuck Barris in the George Clooney-directed film Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, a movie that I like, but Josh, you seem to absolutely adore.
Yeah, really love it.
And it's the reason why you did pick George Clooney as the answer. Mm-hmm. To our poll question last week, we wanted to know which actor turned director is off to the best start. We gave you three choices here to try to narrow it down a little bit. We're not suggesting these are the three best actor turned directors making movies right now, but just three that are contemporaries. There's Ben Affleck, of course, of Argo, George Clooney of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Good Night and Good Luck, and Jon Favreau, who directed Maid, Elf, and Iron Man. How did it come out, Josh?
Well, as you teased, Favreau did not fare very well at all. Only 9% of the vote. George Clooney came in second with 26% of the vote, so running away with it was Affleck, 65%.
Does that surprise you at all? I thought Affleck would win, but that's,
yeah, that surprises
that's a
me
lot.
That it's that strong. Mm-hmm.
Well, Larry disagrees with the majority. He says the only chance Affleck has to become a respected name as a director is to quit acting in his own movies. He's not bad, but as long as the spotlight is on him as a boring movie star, there's not going to be any buzz for him as a director. Hence, his only film to date is Gone Baby Gone, according to Larry.
He's definitely boring in Argo. I agree with that. Art's on my side, too. He wrote, I went with Clooney because of what he had done in the past. Good Night and Good Luck and even Ides of March. I think that Affleck will have the longer career as a director because of the potential he showed with The Town and Argo.
We also got this note from a listener who took umbrage with our choices. CB says, Thomas McCarthy, The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win-Win, were all home runs in my book. Clooney's good, but then there's Leatherheads. Affleck's Gone Baby Gone was great, but The Town was by the numbers. And who is this other guy? Favreau? These guys can't touch Thomas McCarthy. He may be right.
I know there's a lot of love for Thomas McCarthy, and I did like The Visitor. I'm probably already in way too much trouble for this show already not liking Argo, but I'm not a big fan of The Station Agent, which
really?
I know is beloved.
It is beloved, and I probably don't love it as much as the world seems to as well,
yeah.
But I do appreciate it, and I also did really like Win-Win. The Visitor, for me, is the weak link in
is
that
it?
Bunch,
okay.
Actually. So I think Thomas McCarthy certainly belongs in any conversation about good actors turned directors, though there is one more name listener Will says we left out.
He suggests Sarah Polley.
Yeah. Which I can see after her two films, Away From
two
Her.
Two films.
And more recently, I think
Take
split
This Waltz,
a little
I'm
bit
a little mixed on,
Take
but
this
Away
Waltz.
From Her, I adore. So.
Yeah, I did like Take This Waltz more than you. We thank everyone who voted in last week's poll. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and vote in this week's poll. As we said, next week on the show, it's our Halloween special. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. Michael Phillips is going to come by for his monthly appearance. We're going to do another Sacred Cow discussion of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. We're also going to talk a little bit about Room 237, the doc that played at the Chicago Film Festival about The Shining. And then we're going to close with our top five terrifying characters. So with that in mind, here's your poll question. You're alone. Your car just broke down in the middle of nowhere. A figure appears out of the woods. Who do you most hope it isn't?
Freddy? Jason? I love that they all just have first names.
That's all you
it's
need.
It's obvious. Leatherface or Michael Myers?
You do need Michael Myers there.
Yeah.
How are you voting, Josh?
In this situation, I'm going with Leatherface. I think Freddy is the scariest
really?
Of those, but if I'm wide awake and in my broken down car, I feel like I could handle Freddy.
Listen to you analyzing
yeah.
it.
Well,
I love
you got to do that if you're going to survive. Leatherface, I don't want to run into.
I think I'd go Leatherface as well, but Jason would be a close second. I remember being very scared as a younger person watching Friday the 13th. Freddy of the four is the one that scares me the least.
Oh, so
doesn't
creepy.
Do anything
the whole
for
concept
me.
Of Nightmare on Elm Street, just terrifying.
Huh. Well, we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Just a couple of quick notes. We do offer our weekly bonus content if you are a Film Spotting app subscriber, or if you just want to go to filmspotting.net and click on apps. All the information you need is there for iPhone, for Android. And this week, we're going to get into some of your feedback on our recent discussion of Rian Johnson's Looper and the top five that corresponded with that review, which was our top five doppelganger movies. So check out our bonus content for that. Also want to promote our sister show, Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. They will have a new show out Tuesday, October 23rd. The Listener's Choice discussion will be Indie Game, the movie. It's a documentary that follows the journeys of indie game developers. It's a new film to me, Josh. It's one I hadn't heard of, but certainly sounds interesting. And obviously, Film Spotting SVU listeners voted for it. So I'm sure Matt and Allison will do a great job talking about that film and also highlighting a lot of great films that are available via streaming. So if you haven't subscribed yet to Film Spotting SVU, highly recommended you do. Just do a search in iTunes or go to filmspottingsvu.com. Who's the cat that woke up out when there's danger all about? Right on. They say this cat Shaft is a bad mother. I'm done my Shaft. It's marathon time again, Adam, where we devote a number of weeks to exploring a particular filmmaker, genre, or period of film history that represents a bit of a blind spot in our movie education. Our last two marathons had a lot to offer, but I don't think any of the films of Robert Bresson or the examples of contemporary Iranian cinema we viewed had music anywhere as infectious as the Isaac Hayes title song for the first film in this marathon. I'd like to see those hybrid movies, though.
Be interesting.
That'd be fun.
It? I think Shaft has the best music. But will these blaxploitation films have the substance to match? I think that's going to be a guiding question throughout this marathon. When are the films from this genre strictly about the style of their time? When do they also have lasting substance? And when might the style be the substance in terms of its social and political import? But let me dial it back a bit for Shaft and ask you a simpler but related question. Is Shaft more than the sum of the beats of its famous title song?
I think it is, though. Can I say that and still say that my favorite part of the movie is the title song?
Sure.
It is the title song, and it is everything about the opening credit sequence. I love the way it starts up on high, looking down on the New York City street. Then you see Shaft come out of the subway station, I believe. And that shot right there does seem to signal that Gordon Parks was maybe trying to send a little bit of a message as director, that there was going to be a certain type of production value to this film, a classical Hollywood aspiration that was maybe lacking in the film that was its precursor, and a lot of people see as really the movie that launched blaxploitation, Sweet Sweetback's Badass mm-hmm. Song. And I brought that up because I do want to take a moment to acknowledge what a lot of listeners have noted, which is, how do you have a blaxploitation marathon without watching Sweet Sweetback?
Right.
Well, we considered it, but we have a couple reasons. One being, after our last two marathons where the films were kind of hard to find, we really wanted to make sure that all of these films were readily available. And all six of these movies are available via Netflix. Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, the Melvin Van Peebles movie, is not. We also wanted to find six movies that we both hadn't seen. You've seen Sweet yeah. Sweetback. I also feel like I have seen it because I've seen the Mario Van Peebles movie, Badass, which is about the making of his father's film. And I've seen other documentaries about blaxploitation that certainly cover Sweet Sweetback. So I think I have some context to then go into a movie like Shaft. But to get back to that opening sequence, did it occur to you at all as you were watching Shaft walk down the street to that music that Parks may have deliberately had him walking by a lot of movie theaters?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of theater marquees where we're seeing names like Robert Redford
yes.
on the marquee. And right away, it tells you that these are Hollywood's heroes. These are the white man's heroes. And now I've got a new hero, the new black hero, to introduce you to. I also love that everything you need to know about him as a character and a man is set up in those first 5 minutes or so. We learn that he carries a badge. We learn that he isn't going to take any crap from anybody on the street. We know that when a car stops short in front of him and almost hits him. And we know as well that he's going to be a friend to the working class or to the disenfranchised. There's a scene where he stops and talks to the blind newspaper vendor. So again, I think we can probably both agree that that opening sequence really is fantastic. And you're right, it's going to be a key question of this marathon, just as it was with our 70s sci-fi marathon, where there was a certain camp factor to those films, and you really had to wonder, okay, is this good almost because it's bad? I think that may come up with some of the movies here in this marathon, and I'm willing to view films like Shaft a little bit through the lens of its time. I think, though, to sum it up, this is a really entertaining film and an important one for ushering in that new black hero of cinema.
Yeah, I think it's hugely important. I think it's throwing down a gauntlet that we're not just going to have the Robert Redfords anymore. I'm glad you brought up that movie marquee touch, which is just a little touch. It's
it
not
is.
In your face. I mean, it's just in the background as
right,
Shaft
the camera's
is walking
zooming
along.
Down.
But of course, it's purposeful. Really, the whole purpose of the film, as I saw it, was to establish Shaft as this powerful, independent, he's innately good but still kind of devilish
yeah.
character.
In it for himself
not,
a little bit.
Yep, and he's not beholden to anyone. He's not
right.
beholden to the cops.
That's key.
He's not beholden to the local mob boss. It doesn't matter if they're black or white. No one's going to hold any power over him. He's an independent hero. And this may sound obvious, and you could ask yourself, well, how is this different than any of the other movie heroes, the lone guns that we've seen since the beginning of film almost? Well, this is 1971 and he's black. That's how it's different. And I think it's dangerous to just set that aside because that's the true power mm-hmm. of this film. And the film essentially worships him.
I mean, yeah.
Almost every moment is geared toward holding him up. Again, in that opening sequence, the cars, he walks across, like, I think it's almost six lanes of traffic, and the cars have to stop for him. It's
right.
like they're bowing down to him.
And he owns New York.
He
yeah.
does. He does. And there's even little subtle touches as when he's getting his shoes shined. He's sitting in the chair, which is slightly elevated, as those chairs are. The camera's down below.
Yeah, it shoots up.
Pointing up at him in reverence. And there's this little thing, I don't even know if it was purposeful, but it feeds into this whole aura where he gets up and the camera kind of nervously stands with him and rises with him. You feel like you're in the court of a king in
yeah.
that scene.
You do.
And you're just in a shoe shine shop.
Now you got about a half a minute. Tell me what the hell you want with me. Police gonna be up here asking why you threw that son of a bitch out the window. Now they can find you dead or alive. Now what's your goddamn story?
Bobby, soon as to bring you uptown.
Did he tell you to mess me up?
He said I was to bring you.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking about Shaft, the opening film from our blaxploitation marathon. We've got five more to come over the next few months. And I think a key way that Gordon Parks shows us this new type of hero we're talking about is to very deliberately co-opt Hollywood conventions, specifically two types of heroes that everyone in 1971 would have been very familiar with. The first being the hard-boiled private detective, and the second being the super spy. And I'll get to the name you're all thinking of in a moment, but there are these abundant noir elements to this film. First of all, the complex plot, double crosses, people withholding information, using each other. There is a big sleep element to this movie. The desk in his office, the fact that he's a private eye,
yep,
who has an office, and when the kingpin, the drug kingpin in town, who has a lot of power and a lot of money, Bumpy, wants to hire him, and he's sitting in his chair, he tells him, you're sitting in my chair.
Right.
You're sitting in the private detective's chair. Cinema requires that I sit in that seat. So I love that. Also, you touched on his independence. His relationship with the law is also just like Sam Spade and other figures from hard-boiled private detective movies. He carries a badge. He knows some cops. He can work with some of them, but he is basically outside the law. He is a black Sam Spade, and the second half of the film shows us that he's also a little bit of a black James Bond. There's one point where he concocts this elaborate plan to get Bumpy's daughter back with makeshift bombs, and I think he jumps through a window at one point,
if I'm remembering. Silly.
I actually think those parts get a little too silly,
yeah,
and I wish there was more Sam Spade and less James Bond. And obviously, like both those characters, women can't keep their hands off him. So Parks is definitely deliberately working within the frameworks of spy movies and hard-boiled private detective movies. And earlier today when I was writing down my notes, I did have to Google Shaft, James Bond influence, just to make sure I wasn't crazy, just to make sure that if I said this on air, people weren't going to write in and say, oh, come on, there's no way they were trying to pay any kind of homage or reference James Bond at all. But I wasn't surprised that the first link that came up was a link to the Wikipedia page for Shaft in Africa, which I think was the third film in the Shaft series. And they have a quote in there where Shaft is given his assignment and he says, now, wait a minute, I'm not James Bond, simply Sam Spade. So the movie is acknowledging those influences. And yeah, of course, as I've tried to argue, he really is a mixture of both.
You mentioned the women. Of course, that's a big part of the persona. And I thought it was interesting how even the sex scene, the first sex scene you get, focuses all on him. The woman is hardly a part of it, which is very different from how these Hollywood films usually go. But you even get a moment where they're going at it and the camera drifts away to a framed photo of Shaft,
right,
on the bedside table
and
or something like that.
And he doesn't seduce her. He just lays there on the couch.
He's the one who's nude,
yeah,
laying on the couch.
Yeah.
The camera focuses on his, and I think it's important, notably much darker skin, where she's kind of caressing his skin. It's all about Shaft in that scene as well.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that for black audiences at the time, it was empowering to go to a theater and see this representation of characters they'd seen on screen over and over again in Bond films, in detective movies, and then see a black hero who was every bit as macho and cool and tough as those white heroes Hollywood had been feeding them. And in some ways, this gets back to your point about his independence. Shaft is better than Bond, because if you think about it, Bond still has to report to someone. He still reports to M. He still works for the government. The man is giving James Bond orders. And one of the themes that runs throughout this movie is this notion of selling out, of selling your soul, compromising your integrity. And one major way you would do that is help the police get what they want. And he does work a little bit in tandem with Andrazi, I think his name is, this white detective. And at one point he says to him, Shaft, I'm not asking you to sell out. But Shaft knows that really is essentially what he's asking him to do, and Shaft recognizes that. And as I was watching the movie and thinking about the empowerment element to Shaft, that independence really is the key part of it, because by the end of the film, he uses the police to help him get the information he needs under the guise of working with them. He saves an innocent girl, reunites a father and daughter. He gets paid well. And in the final scene, after doing all that, he gets to tell the cops off.
Right.
That's the close of the film. He gets to tell the cops off. So he uses the system to his advantage. He walks away slightly injured, but otherwise his integrity is completely intact. He did it his way.
What's interesting about all that, though, is he unites the community in the process of doing that. He has the cops who he's using to a degree, yes, but he also has the gangster, the local gangster, and he has this Black Panther-like group,
right,
that he teams up with. He's a man apart from all of these, but in a way, to rescue the kidnapped woman, he has to bring them all together. So he unites these forces in mm-hmm. the community for this mission, and only the outside figure can do this. Now, of course, they're united against outsiders, the Italian mafia, who's coming in on their turf. So you could ask, well, maybe the enlightenment of the film ends there in demonizing another to unite this community.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how Shaft the man alone also serves as a uniter. And I want to touch back on what you talked about quickly here, empowering the audiences of the time. I think that's a huge part of the movie's importance and its legacy. Not only that audiences took on this confidence as moviegoers, urban audiences where the film was a huge hit, but really filmmakers as well. Generations of filmmakers then took this on as proof that, okay, we can make our own movies, tell our own stories. And so you see that, you know, through all of the films that followed, some bad, some good, through blaxploitation. But it's really why I do think this is a good place to start the marathon.
It makes me think of a line from the Isaac Julian documentary called Badass Cinema that is about blaxploitation. And I don't remember who the talking head is, and I'm just going to paraphrase it here, but someone being interviewed talks about perceived power. They talk about the Black Panthers at the time come out in this militant way and try to show you how powerful they are, even though the reality was nobody in Black America had any power at that time. I think that Shaft is the personification of that perceived power, and maybe that perceived power will eventually translate into real power. So Shaft is the first film in our Blaxploitation marathon. Our next movie will be Superfly. That's in 2 weeks, so you have a little bit of time to catch up with both Shaft and Superfly. For complete details, visit filmspotting.net and click on marathons.
I like being a film critic, but what I really want to do is direct myself. The Film Spotting Top 5, movies directed by their stars, is next. Stay with us.
You may have to drag me away from my demons, kicking and screaming. It's been so long I've been with them. Don't know where they stop, and I begin.
Before we get into our donations and thank yous, I wanted to take a moment for a couple of acknowledgements. First, on a lighter note, I went to the Film Spotting P.O. box the other day to find a copy of 5001 Nights at the Movies. This is a compendium of Pauline Kael reviews. I think all of them were written for the goings-on about town section of The New Yorker, so they're smaller reviews, but there's something like 3,000 reviews in this book, and it was sent to us by Picador Books. So I look forward to diving into that, because as much as I'm aware of Pauline Kael and I've read some of her memorable reviews, and I know many film critics revere her, there's a lot of her stuff I've never read, so maybe this will give me an opportunity.
It's probably the most well-worn book on my desk.
Is it?
Yeah, if you go to my Facebook page, actually, you'll see a picture. It's right up there with a bunch of books, and that one has a lot of creases on the binding.
What did Pauline Kael say about 12 Angry Men?
You know what? I did look that up recently, and she is in favor of it.
You don't say.
Yeah. I thought she, of all people, might be able to back me up. But
maybe.
No.
Found Pauline out. Wasn't there for you. I do want to go to a sad note here that came to us from Thomas Torrey, longtime listener. We've read some of his stuff on air. We've played voicemails from him. He lives in Fort Mill, South Carolina. And he sent us a note a couple weeks ago because he was looking for our help, really. He wanted to know if we could get a mention out on our show about his friend and fellow Film Spotting devotee, John Daly, who had gone missing. It had been 4 or 5 days by that point, and he was looking to raise some awareness. They'd set up a Facebook page. The family and obviously his friends were very saddened by his disappearance and looking for any kind of answers. And we were all set to give that acknowledgement and try to help in the search for John. And by the time the show came around, they did get news that his body had been discovered in the Charles River. So they're still looking for some answers. The exact cause of death hasn't been revealed, but I know we wanted to express our condolences to John's family and to his friends like Thomas. It's really sad to hear about something like that happening to anyone, but especially someone so young. Let's go ahead and get to our thank yous now. And as always, this segment is brought to you by the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. His podcast is available in iTunes.
Yeah, Jeff listened in on a 2011 Comic-Con panel featuring magician comedians Penn and Teller. And he also recently interviewed writer-director Rian Johnson about Looper. I'm sure that will be good. Jeff's other big news, of course, is Backstory, which is the iPad magazine that he launched. He has filmmaker interviews there, full-length scripts as well, short films, all sorts of stuff. You can type Backstory into the iPad app store to download the first issue for free for a limited time, and then keep an eye out for the web version. That's supposed to be coming later this year. It's going to be at backstory.net.
Well, Josh, we have some very generous donations this week and five or six notes we wanted to share from our listeners. We start with a $10 a month subscriber. Thank you so much, Adolfo, here in Chicago.
Long time listener since all the way back to the Brokeback Mountain episode in 2005. And after years of low paying jobs, I'm finally in a position to throw a little financial support your way. Better 7 years late than never, right? I'd also like to let you guys know that about 2 years ago, my girlfriend moved to Chicago for a job opportunity, putting us in a long-distance relationship. When I would visit her, film spotting kept me company on those long 10-hour road trips between Chicago and central Pennsylvania. So for that, I thank you. Fast forward to the present. I now live and work in Chicago, and we will be getting married in May.
Congratulations.
Thanks for all the great episodes, and keep them coming.
You know, I think Adolfo's trying to say is he can't quit us.
Apparently not.
We also have a new gold-level donation from Peter in Richmond Hill, Ontario.
I was listening to you guys singing during Massacre Theater. My ears were hurting, but yet I was laughing so hard at the same time. So I decided that it's time to donate again. I can't think of a podcast that goes to such great length to provide great insight into movies and provide entertainment at the same time. Keep up the great work. P.S. I would like to hear Josh doing Al Pacino, Scent of a Woman version, in a future Massacre Theater. I couldn't imagine what it would sound like.
You can't imagine it either, because have you still not seen Scent of a Woman?
I've seen parts of it here and there. I've probably seen more impressions of Al Pacino
right.
in Scent of a Woman than anything else. So I'm sure I could pull it off.
Well, you know, it came up on a recent top five for me. I think it's one you need to see and give a little bit of attention to. So maybe at some point down the road, we can get to that, Peter. And it's funny because you're going to hear from another listener who donated money basically just because of our rendition of the Terrier song from Best in Show. I think you put it nicely on Twitter. We were singing for our money.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, I think we have to do more of that.
A new Silver Club donation from Dell in Hove, East Sussex. I don't know if I said that right or not, but thank you, Dell. New $5 a month donations from Jen Larson in Yakima, Washington, and Paul DeNigris in Glendale, Arizona.
Film spotting and now SVU are how I survive my 70-plus miles in the car every day as I commute to my job as a film professor at a small private college called the University of Advancing Technology in Tempe. I'll let you in on my teaching secret. Anytime I run out of stuff to talk about in class, I just fall back on whatever you guys have been talking about on the show. Works like a charm.
Fair enough. He goes on. Anyway, my donation is actually being made in honor of my amazing students at UAT who just recently completed a 14-month film project, Red Sand, a Mass Effect fan film based on the best-selling video game franchise. I'll note here real quick that the only reason I know anything about Mass Effect is because I saw the Morgan Spurlock documentary Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah.
The one he just recently made. I can't remember the full title of it, but it's actually worth watching. And there's a woman in there who wants to be like a makeup artist, and they go put on this show where everyone's dressed up like characters from Mass Effect. Anyway, Paul goes on. He says, we even cast the lead voice actor from the games, Mark Meer, to come out and be in our film. And now, after more than a year of visual effects work, the film has been released on YouTube and has already scored over 30,000 views in the first 24 hours. So my new $5 a month donation is to let all the students in the UAT digital video program know how proud of them I am.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
That's a lot more views than our late live show appearance got on YouTube, I think.
You had to bring that up. You had to bring that up. But as it should be, of course, Josh, and we will link to that YouTube video in our show notes. We encourage you to see what Paul's class is up to. That brings us to this donation. We got two more notes here from Maggie Hart in Denver.
I have been listening to the show for about 6 years now and have thought about donating many times. You have led me to many cinematic discoveries throughout the years, and my boyfriend and I are currently enjoying going back through your marathons. I finally put my foot down to become a donor after your amazing yet cringeworthy musical performance on Massacre Theater last week. That not only deserves a buck for last week's show, but every show that follows. Thanks for the wonderful laughs and great film discussions.
Do you think we'll wear out the welcome and it will lose some effect if we sang every week?
Yeah, I think people would start demanding money back at that point.
Maybe so. Chris Bowen from Stretton, Queensland, Australia writes in, I wanted to contact you and say thank you sincerely for all the years of film spotting. I've listened to a lot of film podcasts. Many have come and gone. Some I think are still around, but yours is the only show I will never miss under any circumstances ever. I'm also listening to SVU now and filling my Netflix queue with the wonderful recommendations. Anyway, again, thank you so much for such a great show. I will listen for as long as you keep them coming, unless, of course, we get another Massacre Theater that destroys Jimmy Stewart. Sincerely, I will stop listening at that point.
See, they can come back to bite you, too.
I can't do my Jimmy Stewart anymore?
No.
That's tragic. Our final two donations, Josh, we want to thank.
Daniel from Milford, Connecticut, and Kyle in Brighton, New York.
Thank you so much, Daniel, Kyle, and everyone who generously donated and shared some kind words with us this week.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Granted, the profit motive in the world economy is the basic root cause for the war. Do you feel that those Americans who are pro-war and who ascribe their motives to patriotism are cynical or naive? And if they're cynical, is it the cynicism of patriots who feel that without a profit motive, the power structure elite of this country will not enter the war, even though they feel that the containment of German militarism may be necessary for...
All right, Miss Bryant, you want an interview? Write this down. Are you naive enough to think containing German militarism has anything to do with this war? Don't you understand that England and France own the world economy and Germany just wants a piece of it? Keep writing, Miss Bryant. Miss Bryant, can't you grasp that J.P. Morgan has loaned England and France $1 billion, and if Germany wins, he won't get it back? More coffee?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's the film Reds, starring Warren Beatty, directed by Warren Beatty, and that helps us set up our top five this week. Movies directed by their stars. Now, Reds is a film, Josh, that has come up recently for me in a couple top five lists.
Yeah, so at least two, I think.
It has. So even though it's a movie I love, it's put aside for this list in what we call the penalty box. Not necessarily in that pantheon just yet, but it is in a little penalty box. It's just getting a timeout. I can't include it on any other top fives for at least the near future. What are some of the other exclusions we came up with for this list? Because we did have to have some guidelines or else it would just get a little bit too one-sided, maybe, or you'd see some of the same names coming up over and over
again. Yeah, it would have
been,
and a list of some of the best films of all time,
exactly.
Because there are some auteurs who, this is what they did, they directed themselves. So we're talking about Orson Welles, Jacques Tati. We put Clint Eastwood and Spike Lee, two more recent filmmakers, mm-hmm. in this list, but you've also got the likes of Woody Allen and Charlie Chaplin. So those have all been set aside, weren't eligible for these lists.
That's right. So this is a non-auteur edition of our top five movies directed by their stars. So movies like Citizen Kane, Do the Right Thing, Annie Hall, they're not going to be mentioned. They wouldn't be mentioned anyway because they're in our pantheon, mm-hmm. among films that we consider to be the greatest ever made. So those were going to be excluded anyway. But yeah, for me, I joked earlier in the show about Woody Allen and having a whole list of just his films. I could do that because I love Manhattan and I love Crimes and Misdemeanors and Hannah and Her Sisters, but we put those aside. Do also want to mention, and we'll link to this in our show notes at filmspotting.net, that recently Film Comment magazine did something very similar. They call it their Trivial 20, and it was self-directed performances. So they focused on the performances, not the movies, and they also discounted auteurs. So we weren't completely off base for doing that. And they expanded their list to 50 online, and it may not surprise you to know that Film Comment came up with some movies that were a little bit more obscure,
yeah, I can imagine.
Than our picks. There are some really interesting names and titles that come up there. So again, if you want to see that list, we'll link to it in our show notes. Before we get to our picks, I did also want to mention this note from Melissa, who is a member of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, one of our listener volunteers. She said, "You could also make a case for some documentary directors being the stars of their films, but I'm not sure you want to go there. Michael Moore, Roger and Me, Morgan Spurlock, Super Size Me, Agnes Varda, The Gleaners and I, Beaches of Agnes." Did you consider that at all, Josh?
It certainly makes sense, but it does seem like it could be its own separate list, possibly.
That's
so.
A good point. What about cameos? We ruled them out, too, didn't we? Or
yeah.
Did you even think about
no,
it? Because,
no, it had to be a significant role. They didn't have to necessarily star, I thought, but
yeah.
It had to be a significant role.
So that's my point. It had to be a significant
yeah.
role. I did factor that in. Martin Scorsese has a great scene in Taxi Driver. Terrence Malick even shows up in Badlands, but we did omit them as well. So with that, I'm going to spoil your list and announce to the world that your number one is Tommy Wiseau's The Room.
How did you know?
I'm sorry. I just had to get it out there. Let's get to your number five.
Well, I should have checked with you on this. Does anyone consider Sylvester Stallone an auteur? I didn't think so, but...
Not if you've seen some of his recent films and heard some of that dialogue, no.
Good. Then he's eligible for my number
he
five.
He is.
Rocky Balboa, directed by Rocky himself,
wow.
Sylvester Stallone. Now, I'm by no means...
Not Rocky II?
No. I'm not a Rocky devotee.
Okay.
I've only sat through two Rocky films in their entirety. The original, which has always struck me as this fountainhead of cliches. And then this final installment, Rocky Balboa, is from 2006. I've sampled others here and there. Of course, you couldn't escape them throughout the years. But enough to give me a feel for the Rocky legend. I don't think that directing is necessarily among Stallone's strongest talents. I've missed most of his other directing efforts. But the fact that he's behind the camera and also behind the screenplay for Rocky Balboa is crucial to what's so fascinating about this movie, because it does work as a commentary on the legend. Mm-hmm. The plot has Rocky coming out of retirement for one last fight. But instead of another groan-inducing embrace of inspirational cliches, which it certainly sounds like, Rocky Balboa is actually a somber admission of a couple interesting things. It talks about old age, the fading of legends. It even addresses the limitations of one's talent. So it can be read as a confession about the entire Rocky franchise. And if you are not a huge fan of that franchise, or if you find it to be hugely overrated, that makes Rocky Balboa a pretty interesting film.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it owes less to the previous Rocky films than it does in a lot of ways to something like Raging Bull, with the Rocky Stallone figure, if you put them together, as this stand-in for the washed-up Jake LaMotta.
What? You haven't peaked yet?
Peaked?
Yeah, peaked.
I don't know. There's still some stuff in the basement.
What basement?
In here.
Tell me about the stuff.
What about it?
Tell me about the stuff inside. Is it angry?
Angry?
Are you mad because Adrian left you?
She didn't leave, Paul. She died.
Okay. Okay, okay, okay.
You know, sometimes it's hard to breathe. You know, I feel like this beast inside me.
Here's how I'll sell it to you, Adam. It's the meta Rocky.
It is a little bit. You don't really have to sell it to me, though. You may have oversold it a little bit. It's a fine movie. I don't know if it's a great movie, but it is one that I was really surprised by because it does work. And after seeing Rocky V, which I would prefer to consider as something that didn't really happen, I certainly had low expectations. And then seeing Rocky Balboa and recognizing that, yes, he does comment on the past Rocky films and he comments on the legacy of it and actually acknowledges that he's a washed up figure. And maybe even Stallone as a writer, director, and actor is washed up. You can't watch it without seeing those meta elements. So I think that's an interesting pick, though. I mentioned Rocky II. That's the one I would have considered because I think Rocky II is a legitimately good film that Stallone did also write, direct, and star in. So,
which one is he fighting in Rocky II?
He's fighting Apollo Creed in that one again.
Okay.
It's the rematch to the original. So there you go. My number five is a movie that's come up a little bit here on the show over the years. And recently, last year, on my top five political movies, it is Bob Roberts, a mockumentary directed by and starring, of course, Tim Robbins. It was his debut as a director. He stars as the title character, who is a Senate candidate who has a lot of charisma. He appropriates Bob Dylan. He takes the tunes and writes his own words to match. He is a hardcore right-wing figure. It's a very funny movie, a very biting political satire that I think works very well. I think Robbins is fantastic in it. Of course, there's a big ensemble as well, including the recently departed Gore Vidal as his opponent, Brickley Paste. Gotta love the name, Brickley Paste. If you look at him, you know why they named him that. And also a very young Jack Black showing up in Bob Roberts.
Oh,
I think his first movie as one of his apostles, as one of his fanatical followers. As we've been through now a presidential debate, a vice presidential debate, and as we're recording this, Josh, the second presidential debate is going on. So I want to play this debate montage from Bob Roberts, and we can all hear just how little things have changed since this movie was made in 1991.
Let's cut taxes. Let's make it possible for the working man to keep the money he earns.
Because that is what politics is really about. Reality, not image.
Vote for me, and I will bring the values of the common man to bear in Washington, D.C. I will bring youth and experience and passion and belief.
So let us be real together.
Thank you for your vote.
Again, that's Bob Roberts, a movie starring and directed by Tim Robbins.
It would be great if Robbins made another feature film. I think he's been doing a lot of TV lately.
Yeah, and plays.
And plays. Okay. Mm-hmm. Dead Man Walking is a fantastic film, which he directed, I think, right after Bob Roberts.
Yeah, and I'm the only person who likes Cradle Will Rock even more than Tim Robbins does. So
oh, you like Cradle Will Rock?
I love that movie.
See?
At least I did when I saw it 10 years ago or 12 years ago, whatever it was. What's your number four?
My number four is Tropic Thunder. Sometimes I feel that if Ben Stiller had said no to half the acting projects he's been in, he would have had the opportunity to make some really dark, almost Billy Wilder-like comedies. I really think he's talented in that area, but instead he does things like Night at the Museum, and there goes a potentially good film he could have directed. I think 2008's Tropic Thunder is evidence. This is where Stiller is doing his Tom Cruise shtick as a fading action hero who's on this disastrous shoot for a Vietnam War film. Stiller's a really generous director here. He allows the ensemble members, people like Robert Downey Jr., even Cruise himself, who has a memorable cameo, they get some of the best moments in this film. And I think the entire film is, in a way, Stiller's apologizing for a lot of the junk that Hollywood does.
Yeah.
He takes shots at everything from pompous war films to Oscar-baiting stars to things like Eddie Murphy's Clumps franchise. It's all really dead on. I did see that Stiller is directing The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is coming out next year. It's from a screenplay by my favorite, Steve Conrad. And maybe this will be the Wilder-esque film I've been waiting for. We'll
see.
That
is a really funny film. Tropic Thunder is a good pick. My number four is Easy Rider, directed by Dennis Hopper, who, of course, stars in the movie as Billy. And you can say this is a film definitely made by its stars because Hopper wrote it along with his co-star, Peter Fonda, who is Wyatt, a.k.a. Captain America. This is, of course, the famous anti-Western. Instead of horses riding out west, these are figures riding their motorcycles into the heart of the country. And it's a movie that was discussed here on the show as part of our New Hollywood Marathon in 2008. And I talked about this then, that I went into the film expecting what I remembered from seeing parts of it as a kid, seeing extended sequences of Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda riding through these great southwestern landscapes, them smoking a lot of pot and waxing philosophically, basically about nothing. And really, I thought it was just going to be this collection of great music and some interesting scenes, but really nothing more than that. Watching it again, I was stunned to realize that Hopper knew what he was doing as the director of this movie. There aren't a lot of wasted scenes. Everything actually fits together quite nicely. And one of the things that surprised me the most was the way this is a movie that is revered as this landmark of the 1960s. But of course, it was made at the end of the 60s, and it doesn't really celebrate the 60s at all. It's actually hailing the end. And the key sequence in the film, though there are many that build up to this and follow it, is the conversation where they realize we blew it.
Yeah. Hey, we did it, man. We did it. We did it. We're rich, man. We're retired in Florida now, mister.
You know, Billy, we blew it.
What? That's what it's all about, man. I mean, like, you know. I mean, you go for the big money, man, and then you're free. You dig?
We blew it.
So these guys think they're outsiders. They think they're part of the counterculture, but what are they doing? They settle for the easy score. They look the part, they sound the part, but the fact is they go for the money. They take the easy way out. They sell out like a lot of people from that generation did. And it was funny because I recently saw the Olivier Assayas film Something in the Air at the Chicago Film Festival. No time to talk about it now, but I have a feeling it will come up on future episodes. And that's another movie about the activism of the 60s, the late 60s in France. And you see that same element there where you see characters who proclaim to be revolutionaries, but ultimately seem to get lost in kind of the hedonism of the time and the selfishness of the time rather than actually doing something for a bigger cause. So Easy Rider is my number four.
This is probably my number six. So I'm glad it was on your list. For number three, though, I went with Singing in the Rain. It's co-directed, of course, by Stanley Donen, but has the indelible stamp of co-director star and, most importantly, perhaps the supervising choreographer, Gene Kelly. Can you direct a movie simply by smiling? Because it seems like that's what Kelly did here. The smile he wears in each scene and the overwhelming joy he expresses while dancing, that becomes the movie's most dominant spirit. And it's hard to imagine this movie without that smile. I think that's partly the reason Singing in the Rain does persist, because by all accounts, this should not hold up as entertainment in our sarcastic and cynical age. There's no way. I can't imagine this movie being accepted now for sure. And it's still somewhat shocking that people look at it afresh in this day and age and adore it. But I think the exuberance of it is so infectious that we just can't resist it. And it has a lot to do with Kelly's personality and performance.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy.
happy again.
Well, I certainly can't resist Singing in the Rain or Gene Kelly's performance. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're counting down our top five movies directed by their stars. My number three is a film, Josh, that has been unofficially in the penalty box for 3.5 years.
Wow, that's a long
time. The last
time
it made a top five, mainly because of one listener, and I'll go ahead and give him his glory. It's a longtime listener, Brett Merriman. He just won't let me forget how many times this movie has made a Film Spotting top five, because not only is it a movie that I love, but both previous co-hosts, Maddie and Sam, also loved the movie and listed it more than a couple times. So, Brett, deal with it. It's been 160 shows. I'm dusting off Henry V.
This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world. But we in it shall be remembered. We few. We happy few. We band of brothers.
Kenneth Branagh's version of Henry V. Not Laurence Olivier's version. And in fairness to Olivier, I did see Branagh's version first, so maybe I was comparing Olivier's a little bit to it, but I think Branagh's is a vastly superior film, mainly because of Branagh's far more complex and human portrayal of the King Henry. I love how he pretty boldly incorporates flashbacks from Henry IV, Part 1 and 2, which are crucial to adding some of that depth to Henry's character. And he just does some really creative things, using Derek Jacobi as the chorus, but instead of being on the stage in the theater, he's on a soundstage. He's making it very clear that this is going to be a film of Henry V. The St. Crispin's Day speech is tremendous. The cast, too, if you just look at it as a who's who of amazing English actors, Jacobi, Branagh, Emma Thompson, Ian Holm, Judi Dench, Paul Scofield, there's even a young Christian Bale in Henry V as well. So there it is. I love this movie, and it's my number three.
I haven't seen Henry V since it came out, so for Brett's sake, I'm not going to revisit it.
Wonderful.
So I can't put it on any list. For number two, I'm picking something that was a complete oversight for my top five charismatic leaders list. I'm going to make up for that now. It's The Apostle from 1997. This is written and directed by Robert Duvall, who also stars as Sonny Dewey, a charismatic preacher whose wandering eye and temper gets him kicked out of his church. The law is also after him. I'm not going to spoil why for people who haven't seen it. So he has to establish a new identity, the Apostle E.F., and he flees to Louisiana and starts preaching there.
How come we call you E.F.? You ain't got a whole name?
Yeah. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. How are you?
Well, I just come in to see what's going on, you know. Music was good. Them kids, friends of yours, these folks here?
Well, they're just children of the Lord. Let's put it that way. We are Jesus Church, and they're Jesus children.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
I'll be down.
Take your hat off.
Oh, I'm sorry. Stand here in the house of the Lord with my hat on. I didn't mean to do that.
Well, can I do anything for you?
I'm just kind of curious why they call you EF. That's all. I don't know.
Well, now, that's no concern to anybody but mine and the Lord. So if you'd like to discuss this outside, that's, you know, that's fine.
Whatever you want.
Yes, sir.
You going to preach to me?
No, sir, I'm not.
The wonderful tension of this film is the way that this deeply flawed man is still capable of great good, both in spite of himself and exactly because of who he is. His faults work in good ways, which is the really perplexing thing about this character. So it's all about Duvall's performance. And it's a prickly performance. It's without a shred of vanity. And I think when we talk about films that are directed by their stars, that's rare. I mean, sometimes the vanity works in favor of the film, but it's still there, that vanity. Here's a film where vanity would sabotage what the movie's going after, and Duvall wisely sets it aside.
I'm glad to see The Apostle on your list because it's one I strongly considered but didn't include. It's among basically 8 or 9 honorable mentions for me, so great pick. My number two is a classic French film from director François Truffaut. It's Day for Night, and of all the picks so far on my list, it's the one with the smallest role by the director. This is an ensemble film, and I wouldn't describe him as one of the top five characters in terms of screen time or lines of dialogue in the movie, but I love the movie so much, and I love the autobiographical nature of it. The fact that Truffaut plays Ferrand, who is the director of the film within a film, which is this melodrama called Meet Pamela. And it's so fun to watch Truffaut play Ferrand because you see even how his dreams, when he's asleep, offset, waiting for the next day of shooting, are about being a child and stealing movie stills from Citizen Kane. So they're not just dreams, they're nightmares, and they're really about what he may not be living up to. His cinematic idols, they seem to be haunting him, and he even gets books delivered to him on the set, which are books about filmmaking and books about other directors. So you see how much it consumes this character's life. On set seems to be the only place that he's completely at home and completely comfortable. People constantly are coming to him with questions. They're asking him to make decisions. He knows what he wants to say. He knows what to do when he's making a film. When he's away from the film set, he doesn't seem to know the right answers. At one point, even his narration says, "What is a film director? Someone who's asked questions about everything." And then we see him deal with those questions. And there's just a serenity to the way Ferrand behaves on set that reflects, I think, how Truffaut must have felt. At least that's the sense you get watching the movie. So Day for Night's my number two.
I'm going to stick with a French filmmaker and a French film for my number one. A little bit older, though, The Rules of the Game. This is director Jean Renoir's 1937 farce about the French aristocracy. It's a regular on top 10 of all time lists, and I think it almost made both mine and Michael Phillips when we did our Sight and Sound show. I think we both had it in 11 through 20, somewhere in there. It's set largely at the country estate of a marquis and traces the various romances and affairs going on both upstairs among the upper class and downstairs with the servants, sometimes even between them. Renoir has the supporting part of Octave. He's a friend of the marquis's wife, but he also has a relationship of one kind or another with just about everyone in the cast, it seems like. And he's a matchmaker of sorts in a lot of ways. It's a background role, yet when you consider the story's ensemble character construction, it's sort of the part that holds everything together. And it's similar to the part that is played by a film's director in a lot of ways, so it makes complete sense. I do think that Rules of the Game is a true classic, and to my mind, it's because of the uncommon empathy that it brings to every one of these characters. No matter how foolish their actions are or immorally they're behaving, there's still this underlying empathy. The only other filmmaker who comes to mind in that way is Pedro Almodovar, actually. I think they're similar in that sense. Now, Renoir's Octave is kind of the model for that. That's how he approaches everyone. He's so generously empathetic, and everyone else kind of follows along.
Well, Rules of the Game is a movie that wasn't in the running for my top 10 Sight and Sound list because I had never seen it. And it's long been, for me, the number one movie I'm most embarrassed to admit I've never seen. I'm usually not embarrassed about that, as people know who listen to this show.
There's a lot of movies out there.
I'm perfectly willing to cop to movies I haven't seen. But the one that I genuinely felt the most ashamed about was having never seen Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game. Knowing this list was coming, knowing that it would probably make your top five, I knew I had to force myself to sit down and watch it, and I did watch it, and I did really love it, but I had five picks I really liked already prepared, so I'm sticking with them. I'm going to cheat a little bit and call this the number one movie I'm no longer embarrassed I've never seen memorial.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to give
credit
to Rules of the Game, which for every reason you articulated is an amazing film. But my number one is another one I'm going to steal from you. You stole my thunder a little bit. It is Singing in the Rain, about the movies. It's my favorite musical. Isn't it everybody's favorite musical? If it's not, it probably should be. As you mentioned, Gene Kelly co-directing with Stanley Donen. And it's interesting that you focus on his smile, because while that is a major part of the film, what I love about it in both the performance and his role as director is seeing how he really merged the camera and the dancing, because I know going back to some of the Busby Berkeley musicals, a lot of times he was a guy who wasn't a choreographer, didn't really care about the dancing so much. He cared about what the camera was doing. He would just sort of use the dancers as props to move a certain way to give him the visual image he wanted. Well, now you've got Gene Kelly coming along, who is an amazing dancer and choreographer and a director, and he says, no, I'm going to merge these all together, and the camera is going to be as athletic and energetic and active as I am. And you really see that in the film. This was also a movie that I screened when I co-taught the Movies About Movies class a couple summers ago at the University of Chicago. It was the third movie in the class. It followed A Star is Born and Mulholland Drive. And especially coming off Mulholland Drive. I worried right up until we screened Singing in the Rain that maybe it wouldn't give us enough to chew on. It just seemed too light and airy and too much fun, and we'd all have a good time, but what would we really say about it? I mean, A Star is Born is one of the classic Hollywood dream movies that shows you that it's also partly myth, and then Mulholland Drive is this complete Hollywood nightmare. We had a ton to talk about with those films, and then Singing in the Rain comes along, and all I'll say is we had a lot to talk about, actually, with that film, especially following Mulholland Drive. If you watch the Club Silencio sequence in Mulholland Drive and then watch Singing in the Rain, you'll never view the climax of Singing in the Rain the same way again.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again.
So that's my number one movie directed by its star, Gene Kelly. Singing in the Rain made both of our lists. What about some honorable mentions for you, Josh?
Well, a couple of recent films, Garden State by Zach Braff. I know there's been a lot of sort of pushback.
You know what? I like that movie, too.
Yeah,
I'm with you.
I think it's really well directed as well. Whip It, directed by Drew Barrymore, is a fun recent little film about women's roller derby. It is. Did you see it?
I've seen a lot of it.
Just not enough to finish it.
No.
Okay. Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks, I considered. And I'm going to give another mention to my recent discovery, The Phantom Carriage, the silent Swedish horror film directed and starring Victor Sjöström.
We got a lot of emails about that. I am a huge fan of Wild Strawberries. I didn't realize that he was the director of The Phantom Carriage, obviously, or I would have said something. I also didn't realize that he starred in that movie. So a good one that could have made your list. For me, I considered Buffalo 66, Vincent Gallo. I love Billy Budd. Terrence Stamp's first appearance on screen. I think this is a movie from the 1960s. Peter Ustinov stars in it and directed the movie. Opening Night, a John Cassavetes film that he has a really kind of small role in. Braveheart, the Mel Gibson film, I think is good. I also like Sling Blade, the Billy Bob Thornton movie. And I got to give some love to friend of the show, Ed Burns, who directed his first film, The Brothers McMullen, and he plays Barry in that film and is really hilarious. So there are many more I could list, and I'm sure that we'll get to some of those in your feedback in the coming weeks. But that was a fun top five. I'm actually a little bit surprised that it's taken us 400-plus shows
to get
to it.
Yeah, I thought for sure this would have been done before.
Well, those are our top five movies directed by their stars. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Well, we mentioned Ed Burns. He is co-starring with Tyler Perry in the new film out wide this weekend, Alex Cross. Also, Paranormal Activity 4 is here just in time.
Good franchise.
Halloween.
I like that one.
I haven't seen any of those movies yet.
Oh, you should.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, they're really good, especially the first one.
Out in limited release, the movie Smashed. This is a dramedy starring Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Easy Money, which is a crime thriller starring Joel Kinnaman, who was part of that Bravo series, The Killing. That's where I know him from, even though I haven't seen it. I know his name. And if I remember correctly, Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate, who's also a friend of the show, is a big fan of this movie, Easy Money. So if you like Dana's recommendations, might be one to see. Also out, For Ellen, which is a new drama starring my favorite actor, Paul Dano. Next week on the show, it is our Halloween special. Michael Phillips will be here. A Sacred Cow discussion of The Shining is on tap. I'm already getting a little freaked out. We'll talk about Room 237 and maybe some other films that we saw at the Chicago International Film Festival. And our top five is terrifying characters.
Has everything ever been tied in so well in one show as that show? I mean,
no.
It seems like,
it's
how
perfect.
Do we do it? Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren.
That's how we do it. Sam actually came up with all three of those topics, I think. So
pretty much.
He gets the credit.
Without Sam and Golden Joe, the show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was the Avett Brothers. Learn more at theavettbrothers.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.